My name is Michael Milne, number 9103. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, the Adams County Court, and Judge Roybal in this matter. We're here because on December 7, 2007, the Adams County District Court granted the appellees, Mr. Bowen's Rule 106A4 petition, and dismissed all charges in Adams County case People versus Bowen for alleged speedy trial violation, and determined that the county court had exceeded its jurisdiction. It's our contention that the district court erroneously granted the petition and erroneously dismissed all charges because it failed to properly apply the speedy trial statute, in particularly 18-1-405 parent 6F. That is an exclusion from the time period, the six-month time period, and that involves a period of any delay caused at the instance of a defendant. And in this case, the main point is that the defense attorney waited till the morning of trial, when a jury was waiting downstairs and the parties had appeared for trial, to renew a motion to dismiss that had been filed approximately 5 months earlier.
Counsel, that's, in my review of the record, that doesn't seem to be quite the case. As you know, my recollection is the defendant filed a motion 3 weeks after pleading, and the court took it up, I think, at a hearing on October 17th, then said, I'll rule on it before trial. On the first day of trial, the court raised the issue, not the defendant. The court said, I see you have a motion here that's not been ruled on. Is that consistent with your understanding?
That's not my recollection from the record. My understanding is that the defense counsel renewed the motion. And the reason why I say that it occurred that morning, there had been at least three other appearances before the court. Two of them occurred in January. The event of the morning of trial was January 26th, 2007. I believe there had been two other appearances by the defense counsel on, I believe, January 10th and January 17th. This motion was pending, and I believe it was counsel who renewed it that morning. And
well, the court, I was looking at the transcript. The court says, I did look at Judge Rinaldi's order following the motions, and there were a couple of unresolved issues that he had not actually decided on and wished for this court to decide. At different points in the trial, there was the defense motion, and it's clear from the context he's talking about the motion involving the wildlife.
On page three,
page three of the transcript.
Yeah, Mr. Cachette raises the issue there about the motion to dismiss.
Right, in response to the court saying that there's a defense motion that hasn't been
correct.
Resolved. So
the issue is,
it's your position, though, that the defendant is responsible for the delay?
That's correct.
Okay.
And part of the reason is, as a proponent of that motion, counsel should have brought that forward or dealt with it at an earlier hearing, particularly since there were at least three appearances before the county court between the hearing in October, that I believe a visiting judge came in and took, ruled on a couple matters, and then took the motion to dismiss under advisement.
So,
in the morning of trial, there's our position that that motion is on the defense. The defense could have proceeded to trial with that, renewed their motion and judgment for a motion of acquittal, but instead chose to take the motion. And I think that's the act that caused the delay in this case, and that's why that provision also applies, in addition to I believe the other exclusion that the defense relies totally on.
Counsel, help me square up something here. The defendant raised the motion to dismiss. There was a hearing. The trial court said, I'll reserve a ruling, and rule before trial. Then we don't hear anything else from him. It's your position that defense had the obligation to raise it in a timely manner. What about those statements in the law that seem to suggest that it's the prosecution and the trial court's obligation to get someone to trial within the speedy trial period? How did those square up?
Well, it certainly is, that is correct, but what we're talking about is the defense counsel having, as proponent of the motion to dismiss, has the burden to get that decided. They can, by that motion, in that untimely manner, defense counsel triggered a delay. It should have been resolved, this whole matter should have been resolved prior to the morning of trial, and as the proponent of that motion, counsel was responsible for that.
Well, what are they supposed to do? They filed the motion timely, the judge just didn't rule on it. What are they supposed to do, remind him, plead with him?
I think in the three other hearings, make that record appear and have that heard. The courts disfavor the hearing of such motions on the morning of trial, particularly where it can lead to, like I said, to having to vacate the trial so that the prosecution can appeal the order that the court made.
Counsel, did you cite us any authority in your brief for the proposition that as the proponent of the motion, the defense counsel had the obligation to get it timely resolved? Did you cite us any authority for that in your brief?
No, Your Honor. I think that's a principle that applies, except for in motions to suppress, generally, that the proponent of a motion has the duty to bring that before the court and litigate it.
Do you recall anything in Williamson that might have been like that or said something like that? I don't know why.
Not offhand. In Williamson, I do recall that, and I think. I do recall that the defendant brought an oral motion on the morning of trial with barely any time left in speedy trial, and that was held to trigger an exclusion under 6F. That's the delay at the instance of the defendant, and in fact, a fairly lengthy one to allow the prosecutor to file a brief to respond to the motion. There is parallels between that case and this case in many areas, except for the fact that in that case, I think in our case, the court actually granted the motion on the morning of trial, and triggering the prosecution's right, I think under 1612.102 paren 1 to appeal that ruling. Because of that action, essentially what occurred here is speedy trial was this motion had not been settled. Basically, the defense action had the effect of running time off the speedy trial clock, because by the time the morning of trial arrived, there was less than a week left in the speedy trial. And obviously, that order of the court granting that motion on the defendant's behalf precipitated the appeal, caused the jury to have to be sent home, and caused the trial to be vacated.
What prevented the people from filing an appeal before February 1?
I think nothing, you know, to be honest, I suppose it was possible. The court had, in its ruling, had given the people 10 days to file that appeal.
Did the court have authority to extend the speedy trial time?
My one of the things that I think applies is because of the court's ruling, and this is an area that's kind of open, because what we're talking about in this kind of appeal, which we're talking about a partial dismissal, basically half the charges were dismissed, half the charges remained. There's a provision for appealing on an expedited basis to the Court of Appeals when that happens in district court, but there does not appear to be a provision in the rules with regard to dismissals at the trial court level in the county court in this. So it's been our position, and we stated that in the brief, that under Rule 37, the county court should have, or I believe does have, authority to stay execution or stay matters in the before it its order. So it did indicate, the court did indicate there was a tolling in its, and had told counsel, you got 10 days, you have 10 days to file this. Now, the how that came about is, I think, in an abundance of caution, the prosecutor is trying to indicate to the court that we think this is an expedited type appeal, but we're not sure. But we'll steer what we think is the more cautious time limit, and that's 10 days. And that's how that came about. And the court said, fine, because we can't have a trial today, and because I'm going to grant your, actually the prosecution asked for permission to appeal, the court granted it, and then the court indicated that the speedy trial time would be told to allow the prosecution to file that paperwork.
If the court had told them they could have 90 days to appeal, would that still work?
No, it wouldn't, Your Honor. I think, well, probably because the appellate periods are probably, you have a variety of appellate periods, 10 days for an interlock, 20 days for, or 30 days for a county court to district court appeal, 45 days, I think, sometimes for the, to the higher courts.
Basically, the speedy trial requirement was to file by February 1, unless you take your position that 6F applies.
That's correct.
So there was really nothing the trial court could do at that stage to extend the time, was there, for the speedy trial?
I think the court did that in when you mentioned that it occurred in Williamson. They get to the, I believe, the same situation. They're there at the morning of trial. Defendant raises a motion to dismiss, and then the court says, okay, well, we need to brief this. I'm going to give you 30 days to brief it, and in the meantime, speedy trial would have lapsed in that situation.
But in that instance, it was raised for the very first time.
That's correct.
So
that's correct.
Basically, your position is that 6F applies because, not because the prosecution and the court has the duty to make sure that rulings are made timely, but because the proponent has a duty to renew that motion timely.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it, this is, in our view, this what occurred here was a concerted effort, I think, to delay ruling on this matter as long as possible, to take advantage of the speedy trial clock.
What evidence do you have of that in the record?
Well, the fact that it did, there were several opportunities, the fact that it occurred the morning of trial and could have been raised earlier.
I understand the chronology, but is there any evidence in the record that shows directly or indirectly that this was the intent of the defense counsel to do this?
Well, as to the intent, we could not prove that, but I believe that clearly the actions are consistent with an intent to set this matter, delay this ruling until the morning of trial, and I think that basically put the court and opposing counsel in a bind.
Couldn't it also be consistent with the view on the defense counsel that he was just hoping that eventually the trial court was going to rule on the motion?
I assume that's a distinct possibility as well. I think, as the court mentioned, the Williamson case, I believe that has application here, as well as, I believe, the cases of we've cited, Jamerson, Warner, the reasoning applies. I mean, the motion's on the defense. They caused the delay, caused the necessity of going through the appellate process. I think what we're talking about here is to say that when the defense makes this motion and the court grants it and then there's a gap in time, that delay does not go to the defense in this matter, I think would allow a situation where the defense could run time off the speedy trial clock, where they could take advantage of their dilatory actions in a case.
And you may be right, counsel, but where the defense had raised the motion months before,
mm-hmm.
How is the defense dilatory? Again, if there was an oversight here, without proof of bad faith by somebody, if there's an oversight here, who should bear that consequence?
I believe that the defense is the proponent. They're the ones who brought the motion and said, hey, we want these charges dismissed. I think in terms of their defense of the defendant, certainly, whether they went into the trial with four counts against the defendant as opposed to eight is certainly an important matter. And at that morning, the prosecution would not have, because this matter was, those charges were still, as far as they knew, they were still proceeding on those charges, and then, of course, the motion was renewed. I think the court, the district court, in its ruling applied the speedy trial statute in a wooden and mechanistic manner. I don't believe that 6B applies by itself, but in concert with 6F in this matter. And I think that the county court made the correct ruling in this matter in analyzing her actions, and I believe the district court erred in overturning that ruling.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd ask the court to reverse that decision.
Thank you. Before we begin, can we add about 20 seconds to the clock? We'll give you a fair shot at this. It's not working. The podium's not working. Was it
down all the way? Thank you.
Ready? All right.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Ana Martinez for the appellee, Daniel J. Bowen. My registration number is 37756. The appellee is asking this court to affirm the district court's issuance of a writ of prohibition against trial court in this matter, finding that it had exceeded Mr. Bowen's speedy trial period. First, I'd like to address some of the facts in this case. I think that they're very important for this court to analyze to whom any delay will be chargeable in this case. And I do want to also point different things out in the record for this court's reference with regard to some of the facts as stated by the prosecution. First, Your Honors, this case has its origin in the winter calving season of 2006. Mr. Bowen is a rancher in Strasburg, Colorado, and he had noted that several of his calves were being attacked and eaten within 24 hours of their birth. And he tried different methods to address this problem. And despite several efforts from playing loud rock music and putting llamas out to even sleeping in the calving pens, he still lost 8 calves over the course of 2 days in January of 2006. Mr. Bowen then resorted to soaking meat in paraquat, which is an herbicide, and putting those pieces of meat on his property in an effort to kill the coyotes. A few weeks later, Mr. Bowen was contacted by some neighbors who had wondered if anyone had put poison out recently. Mr. Bowen explained what he had done. The neighbors had believed that their dogs, a total of 4 dogs belonging to 2 neighbors, they attributed the death of their dogs to exposure to the paraquat poisoned meat. The district attorney brought 2 cases against Mr. Bowen. Each case addressed the death of 2 dogs. Belonging to the 2 different owners. And in each case, Mr. Bowen was charged with 2 counts of misdemeanor animal cruelty and 2 counts of what I'll refer to as the wildlife charges. Specifically, the charges read that Mr. Bowen violated a prohibition against using explosives, toxicants, and poisons for, quote, the purpose of hunting, taking, or harassing any wildlife, to wit, dog, rooster, dog Tanner, dog Boomer, and dog Kirby. Mr. Bowen entered his plea of not guilty to all charges on August 1st, 2006, and 20 days later he filed a motion to dismiss only the wildlife charges in this case. Mr. Bowen's theory was that as wildlife charges found in the wildlife section of the Colorado statutes, it specifically precluded application to domestic animals. And because the charges were brought to wit dog and then named the victim dog, Mr. Bowen believed that those charges were inappropriate. Speedy trial was set to run in this case on February 1st, 2007. Although Mr. Bowen filed a motion to dismiss in this case, the prosecution never actually responded to this motion. Instead, on August 31st, the prosecution had filed a motion to amend the charges. The court can refer to volume 2 at page 300 and page 428 for what this amendment read. They sought to amend the charges by, quote, excluding the specific naming of the victim dogs, Rooster and Tanner, Boomer and Kirby. The trial court finally had a motions hearing in this case on October 17, 2006. Judge Rinaldi was sitting in for the court that day as Judge Roybal was unavailable. The trial court had noted that the prosecution did not file a response to the motion to dismiss, but rather than resolving the motion to dismiss that day, the trial court was careful to say that it would grant the prosecution's motion to amend the wildlife charges. However, in its written order on October 19th, 2006, that can be found at volume 2 at page 318, the trial court, through Judge Rinaldi, had stated that it did not believe that this amendment, removing the victim names, cured the defect that defendant's motion to dismiss addressed. Because of this specific concern, the trial court actually stated in that ruling that it was holding Mr. Bowen's motion to dismiss in abeyance until the morning of trial. At this point, almost 3 months remained until Mr. Bowen was going
specifically to trial. Said it was holding in abeyance until the morning of trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not just before trial?
I believe it is until the morning of trial. I can pull the quote for you at page 318.
That's okay. We'll look. Thank you.
On the morning of trial, which was on January 26, 2007, the trial court heard all the outstanding motions in the case. As the court's already pointed out in volume 4, there is a transcript of that hearing. And in fact, Judge Roybal acknowledges that there were outstanding motions not resolved by Judge Rinaldi at page 3, where she acknowledges that the motion to dismiss the wildlife charges was still pending. At this point, the prosecution had done nothing to address Judge Rinaldi's concerns that the amendment did not cure this fundamental defect that the wildlife statute could not apply to domestic dogs. The trial court indeed granted the motion to dismiss. After it did so, the prosecution then went further and actually asked for an oral motion to reamend the charges on a new theory that Mr. Bowen was being charged for killing coyotes. Prosecution admitted at page 4 that it actually had no evidence of any dead coyotes, and the trial court did not entertain any further motions on that issue. The prosecution announced that instead of proceeding to trial on the remaining 4 counts of misdemeanor animal cruelty, that it instead was going to pursue an interlocutory appeal pursuant to the interlocutory appeal or prosecutorial appeal statute. Mr. Bowen at this point had objected to any further delays in light of his speedy trial rights, and that can be found also at volume 4, page 18. The trial court had decided to permit the prosecution to pursue its interlocutory appeal rather than go forward with the trial that day. And I understand that the prosecution is finding that the trial court had somehow stayed the case or somehow continued the case over Mr. Bowen's objection, and in so doing had also told speedy trial. However, Your Honors can refer to volume 4 starting at page 17, line 23, where Judge Roybal has confirmed that she'll grant the people's request for an interlocutory appeal. And she continues that they will not be having a jury trial that day. And at the very bottom of page 18, on line 23, the court says, "And what that means to you, Mr. Bowen, is because there is an issue that the DA wants to appeal to a higher court regarding the court's decision to dismiss some of the charges today. We will wait till they file their appeal, and that tolls the case. So even though your speedy trial was set to run on February 1st, everything will be told." I believe that Judge Roybal clearly understood that upon filing of a notice of interlocutory appeal, as stated in several cases, that that would indeed also have the effect of tolling speedy trial. The speedy trial statute requires the prosecution and the trial court to bring a defendant to trial within 6 months, or there will be a dismissal. However, certain delays that fall into the exclusion category set forth in the statute will literally toll or stop the speedy trial clock from running. That can be found at section 18-1-405. There's no statutory exception in this case that justifies the delay in bringing Mr. Bowen to trial. The district court had agreed with this proposition and ruled that speedy trial indeed expired on February 1st, 2007, and that nothing occurred to toll Speedy prior to that date. As I've mentioned, the prosecution had sought an interlocutory appeal, but did not actually file that appeal until February 5th, 2007, 4 days after Speedy trial had already expired. Mr. Bowen had raised the issue of speedy trial immediately thereafter when the prosecution attempted to file their interlocutory appeal with the district court. Judge Milonakis had determined he would not hear that issue because it was not raised below. However, Mr. Bowen could not raise the issue below because there was no longer jurisdiction in the trial court. After the interlocutory appeal was resolved in favor of the prosecution and sent back down, Mr. Bowen again renewed his motion to dismiss all charges for violation of speedy trial. Important to note is that the only statutory subsection that could possibly be applicable in this case to stop speedy trial would have been the filing of an interlocutory appeal. Subsection B, yes, sir.
Just to say, why couldn't 6F apply as well? Are there other cases where 6F applies in conjunction with another provision of 6 as well?
No, Your Honor, there's not.
There are not. There's not a single case where 6F works in conjunction with another provision of subsection 6.
There are indeed cases where the court has permitted stacking of different provisions to calculate when speedy trial is told and for how long. For instance, 6B works in conjunction with subsection 6H, which is the time required to reset the case for trial after an interlocutory appeal is successfully made. However, what the prosecution is advocating here is for a combination of 6F and subsection 6B. As you already know, 6F precludes any delay at the instance of the defendant, and 6B precludes the time of delay because of an interlocutory appeal. However, it is important to note that in these cases, what have the courts done to interpret how this operates in real time? Under subsection 6B, the period of delay caused by an interlocutory appeal actually commences on the day the appeal is filed. People versus Hampton stands for that proposition. In People versus Gallegos, the Supreme Court recently reaffirmed that all appeals from interlocutory orders are deemed interlocutory appeals for purposes of the speedy trial statute. Had the prosecution actually filed its appeal by February 1st, the speedy trial clock would have tolled and Mr. Bowen would not be here today.
What happens if defendant raised a motion to dismiss for the first time on the morning of trial?
I believe that the facts of Williamson versus People are absolutely distinguishable. In Williamson versus People, the court was in an awkward position. On the morning of trial,
so is your answer 6F would apply then?
Absolutely not. There are two reasons. First, under 6B, only interlocutory appeals will be excluded, and the court has never, when determining that period of time, stacked additional time to extend that period to include the 10-day filing period.
Has the court ever been confronted with a last-minute motion?
Yes, it has, in Williamson versus People. However, 6B was not at issue in that case.
They didn't do an interlocutory appeal right away, did they? I thought they did a 30-day briefing period.
No, Your Honor, what occurred was on the morning of trial, the defendant for the first time raised an oral motion to dismiss all charges without any brief in violation of Criminal Rule 12B. The court was unable to rule on the motion because there was no written authority even for it. The defendant actually agreed to the briefing schedule, and he was notified through the briefing schedule that it would not finish running until after speedy trial ran. He went ahead and pursued this motion to dismiss. He did file a brief, and the trial court did grant the motion to dismiss. And after it granted the motion to dismiss, and I'm sorry, the trial court did not grant the motion to dismiss in that case and proceeded to bring the defendant to trial. Mr. Williamson then tried to raise a speedy issue after that, which the appellate court denied and said, no, you've agreed and acquiesced to the briefing schedule in that case.
So are you saying 6F applies only when there's a waiver or acquiescence by the defendant?
I believe People versus Arledge, a recent Supreme Court case, 938 P. 2nd 160, explains more thoroughly what is required in 6F. Just because the origin of a motion is from the defendant will not automatically mean that 6F applies or that it would even that the time of delay would be chargeable to the defendant.
Excuse me, back to my question. I'm not sure you answered it. Are you saying that consent or acquiescence is a precondition of 6F?
I believe that it's not absolutely required. However, what the court has ruled is that if you're going to apply 6F, it's an ad hoc inquiry, as stated in People versus Scales. And this court stated, in the interest of NP, that the court has to look at the facts leading to the delay. Mr. Bone filed this motion on August 21st, 2006. There's no reason for the prosecution to wait until after speedy trial had already passed to file its interlocutory appeal. The motion to dismiss was held in abeyance on the trial court's own authority. Delays can also be attributable to the trial court, not just to the prosecution. The Supreme Court held that also in People v. Arledge, where it pointed out that a dilatory ruling on a motion can be chargeable to the trial court, as it was in that case when sua sponte, the trial court, had decided to revive a motion for recusal and dismissed himself from overseeing the case the day before trial. This is not a case of a motion to dismiss filed on the eve of trial. Mr. Bowen was dilatory, it was not dilatory in attempting to resolve that motion, and it is the burden of both the trial court and the prosecution to have speedy trial, to comply with speedy trial, which they did not do in this case. Does your honors have any questions?
So you're saying 6F does not apply in this case because it's your position that the defendant didn't cause the delay, but you're not saying that 6F could not have applied under a different set of facts?
I do not believe that 6F could apply. I see that my time has passed. May I answer?
You actually have another 20 seconds. We didn't get the 20 seconds right for you. So, and by the way, you may answer the question.
Okay, thank you. Under 6F, Your Honor, we don't believe that ever that the prosecution is permitted to stack 6F in addition to the time period excludable under 6B. We understand 6B could be excludable. 6F cannot be added to, and I would ask the court to refer to People versus Hampton for that notion. That is over a 20-year-old case, which has been reaffirmed again in People versus Gallegos. In that case, what the Supreme Court did was they had to determine how much time is actually excludable in an interlocutory appeal from speedy trial. There was a dispute over when that date started. The Supreme Court actually went through all of the facts in the case of when motions were filed. It noted in Hampton that I would just ask that the court affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff shall announce.